Morning. So we're going to switch our focus from pertussis to parapertussis. And this presentation will offer guidelines on parapertussis case management and public health response. So the objectives for this presentation are to describe the parapertussis organism, to explain why CDC is developing guidelines for parapertussis, and to propose these guidelines based on the current evidence. First, this table compares Bordetella pertussis and parapertussis. Both are small, gram-negative bacilli and from the same genus. Pertussis is also known as whooping cough, and parapertussis, as I will discuss later, can cause whooping cough syndrome, which is usually milder than for pertussis. Unlike pertussis, parapertussis has no clinical case definition, and so parapertussis is only diagnosed by laboratory tests, including culture, polymerase chain reaction, or PCR, and serology. Except in special studies that are specifically looking for parapertussis, parapertussis is usually only picked up when the patient is tested for pertussis, and laboratory tests show parapertussis instead. Parapertussis does not express the pertussin toxin, which differentiates it from pertussis and is also likely the reason that lymphocytosis is rarely observed. And finally, parapertussis has minimal to no immunity from either the whole cell or acellular pertussis vaccines. In the last several years, parapertussis has become easier to diagnose with the use of PCR, and several states have contacted CDC about if and how to respond to cases. So in CDC's guidelines for the control of pertussis outbreaks, there are very few statements about parapertussis management, and they're buried within larger sections and really difficult to find. One statement listed here says that parapertussis cases do not need to be investigated or reported, but there's no description of the evidence behind this statement. CDC is currently revising the pertussis guidelines and plans to include a section about parapertussis, which will describe the evidence and rationale behind our recommended guidelines. So these two questions were formulated to help determine appropriate parapertussis guidelines. The first is, how do states currently respond to reports of parapertussis? And the second, does the burden of disease warrant a public health response? The burden of disease was assessed by examining both the epidemiology of parapertussis and clinical presentation and severity. To answer the first question, a survey was emailed to all state health departments in February of this year, assessing whether states have received reports of parapertussis in the last 12 months. States were asked whether they routinely investigate cases and whether they use official or informal guidelines. Official guidelines are ones created by their state, whereas informal guidelines are based on experience, data, dialogue with CDC, or other state guidelines. Finally, respondents were asked their opinion on whether they think parapertussis cases should be routinely investigated. There was a 100% response rate to the survey, with all 50 states responding. This graph shows the response to two of the questions. On the left, 64% of states responded that their health department had received notifications of parapertussis cases in the last 12 months, while 36% had not. On the right, 12% of states reported that they routinely identify contacts of parapertussis cases, and 88% reported that they do not. Of these responses, 4 out of the 6 states that routinely identify contacts also routinely give chemoprophylaxis. And 3 out of the 44 states that reported they do not routinely identify contacts report that they routinely give chemoprophylaxis. When deciding whether to respond to reports of parapertussis, 32% of states follow informal guidelines, which, as I said before, is based on experience, data, dialogue with CDC, or other state guidelines. 6%, or 3 states, have their own health department's official guidelines, and 62% do not follow guidelines. 22% of respondents believe that health departments should routinely respond to parapertussis cases. 32% did not, and 46% wrote in an answer. These other answers varied, but often discussed specific situations, like if it were an outbreak or depending on age or severity. And several respondents also wrote in at the end of the survey that while they do not necessarily investigate parapertussis, they would like clear guidance from CDC. To answer the second question, whether parapertussis is a public health burden, we conducted a review of the English language literature from 1937, which is when parapertussis was first discovered, to 2010. We searched multiple keywords in PubMed and Web of Knowledge and included articles about epidemiology, clinical presentation, special populations, which include infants, elderly, and the immunocompromised, and treatment. An overall 70 articles were included. So first, I'll describe the epidemiology of parapertussis. This is kind of a fun slide, and I'll go through it a little bit slowly. So this graph shows data on culture-confirmed pertussis on the top and parapertussis on the bottom from passive surveillance in Denmark over 24 years. On the top, the unbroken line curve is the total number of examined specimens, and the dotted line is the number of cultures that are positive for pertussis. The red line on the bottom graph shows the number of cultures positive for parapertussis, and the hatched peaks emphasize outbreaks. So as you can see here, parapertussis and pertussis are both cyclical, and peaks occur every 2 to 3 years, although not at the same time. Additionally, the number of cultures positive for pertussis is up to 10 times higher than for parapertussis at a given time. Multiple studies from Europe in the 1990s evaluated the incidence of endemic symptomatic disease. 5 articles stood out from the literature, which included 3 double-blind randomized controlled pertussis vaccine efficacy studies in which parapertussis was studied in sub-analyses, and 2 active surveillance studies for pertussis and for parapertussis. Patients were only tested for pertussis and parapertussis if they were symptomatic, and in the randomized controlled trials, symptomatic meant having a cough for more than 7 days. The diagnostic methods varied within the studies and included a combination of culture, PCR, serology, and epidemiologic linking to another lab-confirmed case. The incidence of disease varied between 0.20 to 2.60 per 100-person years. However, in the study that found the highest incidence, the incidence decreased from 2.60 to 0.35 per 100-person years when cases that were culture positive and not serology positive were included. Culture is generally more reliable than serology. Serology has unknown laboratory and clinical sensitivity and specificity. The incidence for parapertussis can be compared with rates of pertussis from some of these same studies. The pertussis rates exhibited much greater variation across the countries studied, with reported rates between 0.48 to 6.60 per 100-person years in vaccinated children, and 2.2 to 16.20 per 100-person years in unvaccinated children. There is very limited data about parapertussis in outbreak settings, but transmission appears to be high. In a study from Finland in 1995, all 38 children in first and second grade were tested by culture after suspicion of a developing outbreak, and 31 children were serologically tested a few days later. Overall, 58% were found to be positive by either culture or serology. However, only 29% would still be considered positive if only culture-positive cases were included. And notably, in a sub-analysis, 67% of the culture-positive children did not actually have any symptoms. Clustering of positive cases has been seen in other studies, and parapertussis is sometimes present in outbreaks of pertussis. However, the percentage of cases that were found positive for symptomatic parapertussis varied among the studies. Shown here is a graph of the seroprevalence of antibodies to parapertussis in healthy people in the Czech Republic in 2001. The percentage of the population with antibodies to parapertussis increases from age 1 at 1.9% to age 10 at 60.9%, and then continues to remain relatively high within about 20%. Here, culture-confirmed symptomatic cases of parapertussis in Denmark over 24 years are separated by age. And as you can see, the bulk of cases, which is about 50%, falls in the preschool age group, ages 2 to 5, a finding of other studies as well. So this slide, together with the previous slide on the continued high seroprevalence of parapertussis, suggests that there's a high degree of natural immunity from parapertussis because of repeated exposures beginning in childhood. I move now to a description of clinical presentation and severity of parapertussis infection. Many studies have found that parapertussis is generally milder than pertussis, often so milder that sometimes people do not even seek medical attention. Additionally, nearly all of the studies that discuss clinical presentation tested children only when they were already symptomatic with cough for 7 days, so they may be only catching the more severe cases. And in fact, a study in the early 1970s estimated that only about 3% of people with parapertussis have moderate or severe disease, which is compared to 75% of pertussis cases in the pre-vaccine era. Now, this graph shows data from an Italian vaccine pertussis efficacy study, and parapertussis cases, which are on the far left, are compared to pertussis cases on the right. The pertussis cases are divided into people who received one of two types of acellular pertussis vaccines, the whole cell pertussis vaccine, or placebo. All symptoms, which include paroxysmal cough, whoop, vomiting, apnea, and cyanosis, were less frequent among parapertussis cases than pertussis cases, regardless of the vaccine group. However, when you examine this closely, the frequency of symptoms in parapertussis cases are only slightly lower than frequency in the pertussis cases which have been vaccinated with the acellular vaccine, pertussis vaccine, and much lower than the non-vaccinated pertussis cases. This graph is from the same Italian study and compares the mean duration of symptoms in days for parapertussis, again on the left, and pertussis on the right. All symptoms lasted longer for pertussis than for parapertussis. Pertussis patients had, on average, a cough or paroxysmal cough lasting 4 weeks longer than parapertussis patients, and a whoop lasting 2 weeks longer. Now, when you compare this slide with the previous slide, even when the frequency of a symptom is somewhat high, the duration of the symptom is usually low for parapertussis, often lasting just 1 day. The studies I just presented only tested for parapertussis if the person had been symptomatic with cough for 7 days. In this study, from West Slovakia in the 1970s, healthy children were tested by culture every 3 months for 2 years. Of 173 children who were positive for parapertussis, 1% had a typical whooping cough-like illness, 5% had a severe irritating cough, 65% had a mild cough, and 29% were asymptomatic. Only 27 hospitalizations were noted in this literature review, although most of the articles did not actually discuss any hospitalizations. Most of the hospitalizations occurred in children younger than 1 year, and at least 3 hospitalizations were due to dual infections, meaning a case positive for both parapertussis and pertussis. Of the 27 hospitalizations, 3 resulted in death. And please compare this number with the mortality rate of pertussis in the United States from 1935 to 1937, which was a few years before pertussis vaccine became widespread. The mortality rate for pertussis was 1.8 per 100,000 population and 80 per 100,000 population in children younger than 1 year. There's limited data on the severity of symptoms in special populations, which suggests that parapertussis may not be especially severe in these populations. There were 2 articles about parapertussis cases in immunocompromised people, specifically HIV patients. One case report described severe parapertussis illness in a 4-year-old HIV-positive child, and a study from Nigeria found increased cases of parapertussis cases in HIV-positive versus HIV-negative patients, but did not comment on statistical significance nor the severity of the parapertussis cases. There's limited data about whether parapertussis is more severe in infants, and data I showed earlier shows that that symptomatic parapertussis is actually more common in ages 2 to 5. However, infants accounted for the majority of reported hospitalizations. There were no studies specifically looking at parapertussis in the elderly. Multiple studies have evaluated in the laboratory which antibiotics are effective against parapertussis, but this has never been translated into clinical studies on antibiotic use. One review article suggested that, despite no data available, severe cases of parapertussis that resembled whooping cough should still be given antibiotics. And there have been no studies evaluating the effectiveness of chemoprophylaxis. So the take-home messages from this presentation are that most state health departments do not currently investigate reports of parapertussis, but many would like clear CDC guidelines. Symptomatic disease found early in life and a high prevalence of antibodies continuing into older age suggest a high population immunity from boosting. There is very low incidence of symptomatic parapertussis, which has been reported, and symptoms are usually mild with very few hospitalizations and only 3 deaths reported. Finally, there is scant evidence on case management and chemoprophylaxis. So based on the low incidence of symptomatic infection and the generally mild clinical outcomes, parapertussis has a very low burden of disease. Therefore, we recommend that reports of parapertussis not be further investigated and chemoprophylaxis to close contacts not be given. it may be warranted to treat with antibiotics symptomatic cases from special populations, which includes infants, the elderly, and the immunocompromised, as this may prevent severity and decrease duration. However, there's very limited data about parapertussis infection in special populations and no data on treatment, and so we're still struggling with this recommendation. We also recognize that the decision to treat will likely have been made clinically prior to laboratory confirmation. And finally, these guidelines will be clearly described in CDC's revised pertussis outbreak response guidelines. Thank you.